Масштабные кадровые перестановки произвел
Большие
сегодня
перестановки в регионах
Путин произвел множественные кадровые
назначения. Масштабная серия кадровых перестановок.
From the Politburo to the court of the Tsar, from the rule of the collective Putin to the reign of the great leader, from Russia Incorporated to Putin Incorporated. It's September, another Russian political season is upon us, and change is clearly in the air. And as Vladimir Putin steadily purges his old inner circle, he isn't just changing personnel, he appears to be abandoning the governing model he's relied on for the past 16 years. So what is the new Putinism? Will it work, or will it undermine the foundations of the Kremlin regime? Hello from our broadcast headquarters in Prague, and welcome to the Power Vertical podcast. My name is Brian Whitmore, author of the Power Vertical blog here at RFURL. Joining me on the Skype line from Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, is Sean Guillory of the University of Pittsburgh Center for Russian and Eastern European Studies, author of Sean's Russian blog, and host of the SRB podcast. Welcome back, Sean.
Hello, nice to be here.
Nice to have you. And joining us from Moscow, making his first appearance on the podcast, is one of my favorite observers of Russian domestic politics, is political analyst Nikolai Petrov of the Center for Political and Geographic Studies. Welcome, Nikolai. I hope your first appearance with us will not be your last.
Hello, thanks for having me.
Thanks for being here. And let's get the ball rolling with Nikolai, since you've been writing a lot on this subject. In a recent piece in Vedomosti, you got everybody's attention by using the S word, arguing that Putin is moving away from the collective rule model used by Leonid Brezhnev and toward one based on one supreme leader, if you will, as was the case under Stalin. Using the S word is always dangerous in Russian politics, but I know what you meant there. You weren't talking about the Stalin of the purges and the repression, but more this model that's based on one leader. What do you see Putin doing here, Nikolai, and why is he doing it, and what are the implications?
Well, first of all, I think that restoration, reconstruction, and redesign of a nomenclaturian system, which has been established by Stalin, is the most successful Putin's long-term project. And this project was almost finished recently due to the confrontation with the West. Otherwise, it could not happen this way. And the difference between Stalin's and Brezhnev's nomenclaturian systems is that it used to be in a good shape under Stalin, when there were fears and there were purges, and it used to be aging and not working that effectively under Brezhnev, when the collective leadership replaced Stalin's personal power.
So you would argue in the first part of Putin's rule, he was using a Brezhnevian style system with the collective leadership and the kind of the collective right to steal, if you will, holding it together. And now he's moving to one that's going to be have perpetual purges involved in it. Am I reading you right there?
Well, I would say that until recently, when describing Putin's elite, we use different models, including the model of a board of directors, with Putin being the chairman of this board, but the chairman who should listen to other board members and showing the general balance of their interests. Now it's different, and Putin more and more looks like a Tsar, who can make certain important decisions without, consulting with other elite members. And what we see now is the fact that he's surrounded more and more by loyal younger servants rather than old comrade-in-arms. But I would say that the system, how it looks now, in my view, is transitional one. So it's not the next stage. It's rather preparation for some important radical moves, which would be impossible if only there would be strong elite members who could somehow resist. Now what we see, Putin is appointing his loyal bodyguards and other guys who do occupy positions occupied earlier by his comrade-in-arms, but without their political weight.
Mm-hmm. So, and we're speaking, of course, of the removal of Vladimir Yakunin at Russian Railways, the removal of Sergei Ivanov as Kremlin chief of staff, the removal of Viktor Ivanov at the Federal Anti-Narcotics Service, and others that have happened. This is what we're talking about. This kind of purging of the inner circle. Sean, let's bring you into the discussion here as a historian. Looking at this historically, the norm in Russian politics, at least to me, appears to have been rule by some kind of collective, whatever you called it. One man rule of the Stalin type in Russia, despite the stereotype, is actually the exception, no?
Well, yeah. I mean, speaking in broad terms, I think that there is always a head, right? Whether it be a tsar or a general secretary of the party, and then you had people under him, and there was more or less a cooperation in terms of dealing with policy and balancing forces and balancing internal court politics. But collective leadership is also a tricky thing. So, for example, under Tsarism, there is never, while, say, a Tsar would consult with his advisors and consult with his ministers, there was rarely a collective body that dealt with decision making. He tended to meet with people individually, or he was influenced by particular individuals within the court.
Mm-hmm.
And under Stalin, I think the one man rule label actually doesn't fully describe how things worked. There's a very interesting new book by Sheila Fitzpatrick called On Stalin's Team that came out late last year. And she's looking at the people around Stalin, so like Molotov, Kaganovich, Mikoyan, and others, this small group of people who were with Stalin for about 30 years. And what she finds is actually really interesting because while, yes, Stalin was the head and he was the final decision maker, he consulted constantly, informally, with his circle of people. And in cases, she points out, when he felt that they weren't fully on board, he would back off, he would reintroduce, he would cajole. And so the one-man rule, you know, Stalin completely dominating over these people doesn't really fit either, because they, as she shows and some other scholars have showed, people like Kaganovich and Mikoyan and Molotov, they had their own spheres and they lobbied constantly to protect those spheres.
Mm-hmm.
So it's a little more complicated, and I don't really see what Putin is doing is moving towards the one-man rule stereotype that we assume under Stalin. He's definitely – I agree with Nikolai what he's saying. He's bringing in people that aren't as embedded in the system,
mm-hmm.
and they are certainly loyal personally to Putin. But at the same time, I ask, well, what leader doesn't do that? What leader brings in people who are going to be conflictual, who are going to cause problems, who are going to go on their own agendas? I would assume most leaders of countries bring in people who are personally loyal to them, and also they feel they're going to be on their agenda. And I do think what's possibly going on is by bringing in these lightweights who don't have their own tails and own ballywicks, that it is setting the stage to do some kind of policy change. And by getting rid of these heavyweights, then you definitely do have less intransigence, you have less foot dragging, et cetera, to try to implement whatever is on the agenda.
And you have less clan warfare, at least for now, until these people build empires.
Right. And I think it's also interesting the way this is happening. I mean, he's moving like Yakunin and Ivanov out, but he's also giving them kind of golden parachutes.
Well, yeah, that's been his style, actually.
You know, but this is significant, though, yeah. Because this is the tendency is that you are, you know, you're out, goodbye, and then you're stripped of, you know, all of your wealth and you know, sometimes maybe even arrested or whatever. And this isn't happening, and it's showing a different mode of dealing, of being able to retire these people. And on the other hand, too, I mean, people, we're all kind of like, oh my God, Putin's making all these moves. But another thing he's doing is he's preventing the system becoming a gerontocracy.
Right.
And if he didn't do it, then we'd all be saying, oh my God, it's becoming a gerontocracy.
Right. Well, Nikolai, you addressed this in a piece in Sloan this week about what happens to the regime's children as it ages, if it ever falls. Nikolai, you also, along the lines of what Sean was saying in another piece in Vietnamese in recent weeks, you basically argued on these personnel decisions that Putin still does have to balance the different interests in the elite. It isn't kind of a one man show. It seemed to be kind of backing off a little bit on what you were saying earlier about moving towards this Stalin model, or did I read you wrong?
Well, if to speak about the Stalin's model, it's the late Stalin model, when he did push aside his old friends mentioned by Sean, and he became surrounded by new guys who didn't help him at a time of troubles. And what strikes me, it's not the fact that what Putin is doing now is irrational. It's rational, but what we see now is very new behavior. Until recently, all this bunch of persons who are now outside of his inner circle used to be a kind of untouchable, and it's not that much about golden parachutes. I think it's not that golden now as it used to be a while ago, but it looks like it's absolutely new and different approach. That's why I'm saying that this is not that much about just change of generations, but this is preparation for a kind of maneuver where, in order not to be opposed by influential elite groups, Putin, creates the room for maneuver.
Mm. Do you have any idea what that move may be, Nikolai?
Yeah, I think that it's pretty much understandable that although Russia has certain financial resources to wait, the problem appears connected with the fact that after the Duma elections this September, the Kremlin should wait for 2018 presidential elections, mm-hmm. and it's hard to make any serious moves which should be unpopular on the eve of presidential elections. So I do think that at first they will try to go to the West to improve relations with the West, to soften sanctions and to borrow money. If so, then it's possible to survive till 2018 without any radical changes. If not, I do see only two probable options. The more positive one is a kind of authoritarian modernization, which was impossible due to resistance of influential elite groups interested to keep status quo a while ago, and which now is becoming much more probable. And the next option is to continue or to finish construction of full-scale authoritarian system, and it needs purges. And it's understandable that elites are not that happy with this idea. So in order to finish construction of the authoritarian system, you need also to suppress probable resistance of elite groups.
Uh-huh. So these are the three scenarios that you spelled out in your excellent report for the European Council on Foreign Relations this spring, where you argued that this regime is changing one way or the other. Of those three possibilities you spelled out, the rapprochement with the West, which I find highly unlikely personally, the authoritarian modernization, and the full-scale authoritarian regime, which of those do you think is most likely?
Well, in my view, it's not like, say, three different options. The first bifurcation point is connected with the fact whether it's possible for the regime to find money, to buy time, and to avoid any radical moves now, waiting for 2018. If not, then there are only two possible options, and I don't think it's rational to speculate about probabilities, because, you know, in Russia all the time, different options are under preparation, different options should be on the table till the very last moment, mm-hmm. and the final decision, I think, is unknown for Putin himself.
Uh-huh. But you think these three options are all on the table, and any one of them could be used.
Yeah, and I would say that we can see signs of all of these options to appear.
Yeah, no, we see them as we speak almost. I mean, with Putin making overtures on the eve of the G20 summit, which happens next week in China. But at the same time, we see the troop buildup on the Ukrainian border and the saber rattling there. So we are seeing contradictory signs. What about that, Sean? Do you think this is likely? These are the three possible ways it can go. And which do you think are most likely?
Well, it's clear to me that from all of the talk in terms of dealing of social services and the welfare state, that they're going to have to tighten the belt and do some kind of austerity. I mean, that has been floating around for the last several months, and they're certainly setting up Medvedev to be the bad cop on this, considering his statements of the last couple month or two. So I think that they're going to have to do some kind of liberalization. And you also see things about, you know, proposals to make it easier to start businesses and to make the climate more favorable to do small businesses. There's all of this kind of discussion of trying to make the climate
just
more
discussion, though.
Well, but yeah, but there's discussion is better than nothing.
Yeah, right.
I mean, in these cases, we don't know what's going to happen, right?
Yeah.
Like, But there's definitely something in the air of – there's various proposals being floated around publicly. Who knows what's going on behind closed doors? But at least publicly, there's lots of discussion of some kind of economic liberalization to some extent. And I think that by putting in – by carving out some of these heavyweights, that this paves the way for that possibility.
Mm-hmm.
There's another thing I wanted to bring up. So we have a bit of a contradiction here, because on the one hand, we all recognize, at least I think we all recognize, the informality of the way Putin governs and the way governance is practiced in Russia. And you pointed this out in your blog post this morning about the Systema.
Mm-hmm.
And then on the other hand, we have people being removed from their institutional basis. Right. They're being, you know, Sergei Ivanov is removed from the presidential administration, for example. So I think one of the things we have to wonder about, what does institutions mean? What does it mean to be ahead of an institution? And how does that relate to one's influence within the internal politics of the Kremlin?
Sean, great minds think alike, because that is exactly where I wanted to take the discussion right now. So that because this is one of the things I'm wondering about now, because Putin, basically your official post didn't really matter. In Russia before.
Didn't matter under Stalin either, by the way.
Right, it didn't matter under Stalin either. You could be the head of Russian railways and be one of the most powerful people in the country, and you could be the prime minister and be completely powerless. Nikolai, what about that? Do you think institutions will start to matter more now?
Well, first of all, I would differ between formal institutions and informal institutions, and I don't think any political system can survive without institutions at all. The problem I see is connected with the fact that at first Putin did weaken formal institutions, starting from the beginning of his presidential term. So we've seen weakening of the government, we've seen weakening of elections, we've seen weakening of local self-administration. And now what we see is weakening of informal institutions. And informal institutions is very important thing. So rules of the game are now different. And those rules of the game, which would never let this or that person to be pushed out in past, do no more work. And nobody knows what exactly are these new rules of the game. So that's why I am saying that the system is in a very fragile state of transition. It's like, say, crab who is changing its, shell.
Mm-hmm.
So he's coming out of his former shell, but before getting the new shell, he's not very safe. And this is exactly where the system is now, when old rules of the game do not work, when there are no strong institutions which could provide for the stability in case of any accidents, where there are no persons except for Putin, most of all, who are influential enough to provide for the stability. And that's why I think this stage cannot last for long. It's very temporary situation, and it should end, I hope, at the end of this year, and we'll see new rules of the game.
Do you
new phase of institutionalization.
So you expect a new phase of institutionalization, but do you see the formal institutions becoming stronger or just new informal institutions?
Both formal institutions first and informal institutions second became weaker now.
But when this crab puts on its new shell, to use the metaphor you used, do you think we'll see formal institutions strengthened, or will Putin continue to rely on the informal?
At least informal institutions are needed for the system to be more or less sustainable.
Now, one thing I've noticed, if you look at the removal of Ivanov, one of the things that jumped out at me, especially now that there's rumors that Vyacheslav Volodin might be moved out of the Kremlin and become Speaker of the State Duma after the elections. There's a lot of speculation about that in the Russian media right now. The first thing that crossed my mind when I was reading that is there's no heavyweights left in the Kremlin administration. And is this also, I mean, is Putin intentionally weakening the Kremlin administration? Nick, do you see that happening, Nikolai? And if so, why?
Well, the reason why I did try to explain, in my view, Putin is preparing for large-scale maneuver. And in order not to let anybody to resist, to play his or her own game, he removes heavyweights and he appoints those guys which by definition are cannot be good managers, cannot stay there on these positions for long, but they are absolutely loyal. Mm-hmm. So what Putin needs now is absolute loyalty and total control over most important corporations, over most important regions, over most important agencies. Mm-hmm. And if to look at the whole chain of personnel replacements, I think it's very rational, it's very logical, it's going on for several years now. It did start from state agencies, then state companies followed, and you've mentioned Russian railroads, there was Rosgidro, and so on. And this year, we've seen the most serious reshuffling of the whole Siloviki camp.
Yes.
So I do think
and
that
the governors,
state management is the next, and political parties, political system, in general political bloc, where Volodin stays, is the next as well.
And I'm not so sure Igor Sechin's so safe, as I read about him losing one political battle after the next. I expected him to go before Ivanov. I don't know if you have any thoughts on that, Nikolai.
Well, yesterday he did accompany Putin at the Far East, showing the new, huge enterprise owned by Rosneft to construct special ships. So I think that his position weakened, but it doesn't mean that he will lose his position pretty soon. And the very case with Bashneft, when the government decided to privatize the company, and it did forbid state companies to participate in this, Sechin did not listen to them, in spite of the public resistance of all economists, not necessarily liberal economists, all governmental economists. And finally, Putin decided to postpone the whole deal.
Yeah.
Which means that neither side can feel itself a winner, but there are no losers as well. So it was a victory by Sechin, I would say.
Uh-huh. Well, one other thing I wanted to touch on too, because there was a really good piece I thought in Sloan by Vladimir Pastuhov this week, the political analyst who's at St. Anthony's, Oxford right now, arguing that basically what Putin's doing right now is undermining the basis for the regime, for the whole basis of the regime's resilience, and it might come back to haunt him. I wanted to quote from that piece and get a reaction from both of you. Pastuhov writes, the regime's unique long-term vitality was due to the fact that in place of institutions, power resided in the informal and often semi-criminal networks. Putin was both the head of state and the leader of this formerly non-existent but very powerful and vast organization. Putin's unique versatility, his ability to be both the prince of light and the prince of darkness, to a large extent explains the success of his regime. And Pastuhov goes on to say that Putin's basically seems to be undermining himself by doing this and putting himself in a very dangerous position. And what this got me thinking is, yeah, he's going against what we call sistema. Right. As they say, the regime's changed, but sistema остается. This is something I think we really have to take into consideration. Sean, what are your thoughts on that? Do you think this is dangerous for Putin to play this game?
I don't understand why this is dangerous.
No, I
don't understand. I also don't understand. And if Nikolai could clarify the rules of the game and then what are the new rules that are changing? Because I don't understand what the new rules are.
So you're much of the Russian elite, I think.
Well, perhaps I am, but I don't. But I'll just leave that out there. But let me just comment on what you put. The problem I think Putin has is his whole entourage and his elite is based on the ability to rent seek and access to state funds and corruption. The problem is that when these people get old, what do you do with them? You can't keep them on the corruption teat forever and still run a state. So part of what I see him doing is he's bringing in – there has to be some generational turnover. And unlike, say, under the Soviet system where you had a very institutionalized nomenklatura system, you had a very institutionalized party system where people were able to kind of rise up from the ranks, or Moscow would pluck you from, you know, some provincial place and you were seen, people would recommend you, hey, he's good out there, he does his job well, let's bring him in and use his talents elsewhere. To me, in my view, under the Putin system, there is no institutionalization of that nomenklatura.
Right.
There's no mechanism for bringing in new cadres. It's entirely informal and personalized. So, in order to regenerate the elite, because he doesn't have that system in place in a formal institutional way, he has to bring in. He has to do it personalized. Right. And so to me, this is one of the mechanisms in which we're seeing a generational turnover. And some people have made this argument in the sense that if you look at who's coming in, they're quite young, relatively. And it's not just about 2018. It's also about 2024.
Right. Right. Nikolai, your thoughts on that?
Well, I would say that although we can call this system neo-nomenklaturian one, it's different from what Stalin did construct in a couple of important ways. It's too mechanical in a sense that it's very personalistic and there is lack of more or less autonomous blocks in this machine. Everything is connected to the president and everything depends from the president. So it looks like an assembly line. In order to change it, it cannot change by itself. It's not inorganic. It's mechanical. So you should stop it. You should redesign it manually, and then it will work one more time. So it's single-use system. And Sean is right. It came to the end of its more or less effective, more or less sustainable existence. And it's needed now to do something to give it the second life. And I think, and I would agree with Vladimir in many different ways, except for the fact that Putin ruins the system. It's right that he is dismantling the old system in order to start the new one. And now we are at the point when the old system is finishing to work in a way it did, and the new system is still not established, and I hope it will appear at the end of this year.
Right. So we're in between, as you said, we're in between two systems. It's almost as if the ghost of Leonid Brezhnev is haunting Putin. He's almost acting like he's determined not to have the ossification of that system, but at the same time, at least keep himself in power, if not right. his cronies, right?
I mean, it makes sense.
Yeah, and
it
this makes... is very important that Putin has pretty long time horizon, unlike Brezhnev. If only he would not look, say, 10, 15 years ahead, he could easily stay with this old system, trying to keep it afloat without any radical moves. Mm-hmm. The fact that he undertakes these moves means that his time horizon is much longer.
Right, and he's determined not to become Brezhnev. Go ahead, Sean.
And if you think about it, I mean, I don't know if Putin is thinking this way, but if you think about it, he came up at the tail end of the Brezhnev period, mm-hmm. right? He lived this period. And then from his point of view, he might say, look, they let the system really, really ossify, and then you get Gorbachev.
Well, first you had Andropov, and that's the kind of modernization Putin wanted.
Right, but that right. But then you get Gorbachev, right? Because even with Andropov, he was too old.
Right.
And you get Gorbachev, and it's a big strike to the system, a breaking of it. And for him, he might and I agree with Nikolai, in his time horizon, he might be thinking, you know, he's thinking a longer period of time, and he might be using those historical lessons, maybe, I don't mm-hmm. know, but using those historical lessons to not repeat the mistakes of the latter part of the Soviet system.
God, so Putin might be a better strategist than I've been giving him credit for, because my mantra has always been he's a great tactician but a lousy strategist. But what I'm hearing here is he's actually a pretty good strategist in terms of the Russia's domestic political arrangements. But I still wanted to, I'm not going to let go of this notion that this is a bit dangerous. This is a bit dangerous of a trick to pull off. I know you both disagree, but I want to quote another bit from Pastuchov, because what we're also seeing, we're not just seeing cadre changes. We're not just seeing purges. We're not just seeing the inner circle culled. We're also seeing what I would call a less bogus than usual battle against corruption. I guess that's the best way I could put it, because it's not a real battle against corruption like we think of it in the West, but it's also not your run-of-the-mill fake anti-corruption drive that you see in Russia, which is usually just some cover for some political maneuver. Putin does seem to be trying to put a lid on the more ostentatious graft that goes on in the system. And I want to quote again from Pastuchov here. He says, corruption remains today, in the absence of ideology, the only effective binding element of the Russian world. It's its saving ether. And Putin, like no other to date, skillfully used the corruption in order to strengthen his personal power. Now, in the same interest, he believes he needs to start fighting corruption, violating the social contract with the old elites. Now, when I said this is dangerous, what I mean is, isn't it possible that the system will fight back against Putin? Because he is going against the grain of how Russia is governed, let's face it, under whomever, not just under Putin. Putin has very skillfully used the corruption as a control mechanism. But this whole system of informal and illicit deals that keeps the system moving is eternal. It was there in the Soviet Union. It was there under Yeltsin. It was there under Putin. And is this going to provoke a backlash? What do you think, Nikolai?
I think that Putin is not fighting against the system like Khrushchev. He's not fighting against corruption. But there are two different kinds of corruption. Corruption to certain limits, as Nikolai Gogol put it, брать по чину, to take bribes according to your rank.
According to your rank,
it
right.
cements the system. It's a very important element, and it should be in place. But when it exceeds these limits, it can destroy the system. And the problem is that these old-fashioned guys who used to be, well, corrupt perhaps at the time of financial, huge financial well-being. They cannot stop now, and it makes it very complicated to fit new generation of managers. So when pushing these guys out, Putin let new generation to get money, to get financial flows, and to enrich themselves. So he acts in their interest, and he acts in the interest of the whole system. So he doesn't fight corruption as such. It would be risky, and you are absolutely right, and it can easily can go out of the control. And second, corruption to a certain extent can increase control, but you should keep it within certain limits. And what Putin does, he rotates leadership, so he is pushing old guys aside, but when replacing them by new guys, he dismantles the whole system of corruption, corrupt connections, which is, well, decreasing corruption for a while. And if to do this on constant base, you can keep corruption within certain limits.
So the social contract with the with these new people coming in, these people like Vino coming in, the new Kremlin chief of staff, they're going to be happy for now with a high rise apartment in Moscow and not a villa, for example. Mm-hmm. But over time, they're going to build empires and they're going to want their villa. So this is just a matter of buying time before the system can revert to the norm, so to speak. Is that what you're saying, Nikolai?
Yes, but what is important, it's the fact that Putin dismantled political machines. First, he dismantled regional political machines, and it led to poor United Russia showing in previous Duma elections. Mm-hmm. And now he dismantles corporate political machines. And this is risky, and this is, like you pointed, it leads to decreasing trust within elites. That's why in these forthcoming elections, for example, the system cannot afford a fraud, because if the governor, who was considered to be a very influential guy in the past, orders his subordinates to deliver results needed, it can work only in the situation if everybody is sure that he is immune due to governor's protection. Mm-hmm. If the guy today is a governor and tomorrow he can go to jail, nobody will realize any orders to violate certain formal rules coming from this weak guy.
And this actually points to maybe that this upcoming Duma election that is in 16 days, it might be a little bit more dangerous for the regime, or might not be as good a result for the regime as we've been expecting. No.
Well, I think that timing is very important. That's why I'm saying that, in my view, we should wait for some very important moves and perhaps U-turns by the end of this year, because the system cannot stay in this situation for long. It's dangerous.
So what we're witnessing now is almost like an airplane going through turbulence before it goes back into smooth air. Sean, last word for you before we move to the second segment.
Yeah, the thing I wonder, and I think Nikolai pointed this out in one of the Vietnamisty pieces, I forget which it was, about the children of these people.
This was in Sloan.
Was this in Sloan? Yeah. Yeah, and I think this is actually really interesting, because I wonder if one of the informal agreements that might be developing is you step aside, but your children are safe. Mm. In the sense of your children can still be on the boards of the banks, your children can still be in the corporate structure, they can still have very good lives, and we're going to secure the generation, the next generation coming up that has benefited from all of the confluence of political power and rent seeking.
That's actually that's interesting. I guess I have to give Nikolai a chance to
because
you wrote that very interesting piece in Sloan about the children of the elite. Nikolai, do you think that's what might be going on, that the children of this old guard are the bargaining chip Putin has, to that they'll be left alone if you just don't make any noise? Do you think that makes sense?
I think that Putin, and you are right when you said that, he thinks carefully about providing retired guys with golden parachutes in order to be sure in their loyalty. Mm. And sons is, children in general, is another hook which can be used in order to not to let any of these guys who perhaps are not very happy with their resignations to oppose the system. From one side, children of elite, are good enough to be loyal servants within the system, although none of them, I think, will make career comparable to fathers. Mm-hmm. But at second point, they can be seen as a kind of hostages to provide loyalty of fathers even after resignation.
Mm, yeah, that makes a lot of sense. And on that note, we'll shift gears. In a few moments, we'll continue our discussion and look at a report released this week alleging massive criminality inside Russia's ruling party. I'd like to remind you, you're listening to the Power Vertical podcast. My name is Brian Whitmore, author of the Power Vertical blog here at RFRL. Joining me on the Skype line from Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, is Sean Guillory of the University of Pittsburgh Center for Russian Eastern European Studies, and author of Sean's Russia blog and host of the SRB podcast. And joining us from Moscow is political analyst Nikolai Petrov of the Center for Political and Geographic Studies. I'd also like to remind you, you could subscribe to the Power Vertical podcast on iTunes. You could read the Power Vertical blog and watch the Daily Vertical at rfrl.org. And you can follow us on the Twitter at Power Vertical.
Партия «Криминальная Россия», который посвящен связям. Когда слышит фразу «партия жуликов и воров», первым делом вспоминает не только в коррупции, не только в мошенничестве, не только во взяточничестве.
Governors and mayors leading organized crime gangs. State Duma deputies laundering money for the mob and running execution squads. Government ministers treating the state budget like a personal ATM. That is basically sums up a new report by opposition figure Ilya Yashin documenting the criminal activities of the ruling United Russia Party. The 66-page report titled Russia's Criminal Party alleges that United Russia has essentially become a vehicle for the political legitimization of organized crime. And it comes just weeks before elections to the State Duma. I argued this week that the most striking thing about Yashin's report was how unsurprising its findings were. Although, by the same token, this report, I think, significantly came out on the same day that a Levada Center poll showed support for United Russia dropping precipitously from 39% to 31%. And one has to wonder, Nikolai, what was your reaction? Do you think this report by Ilya Yashin will have any impact? Is it just telling the Russian people what they already know, suspect, and don't really care about? Or is there something larger here?
Well, if to speak about sociological polls results, it's possible to speculate about all these oscillations, and what we see now is essentially increase of the Just Russia popularity, mm-hmm. which cannot be explained in a way we can easily explain the decrease of the United Russia popularity. So mm-hmm. the general idea is that it's understandable that at the beginning or in result of very short electoral campaign, the party of power should lose part of its popularity because other parties are starting to campaign, other parties are starting to criticize the party of power and so on. So anyway, this, I think, is not a threat for the United Russia, which can easily count to get 40 to 45% by party list and additionally 180, 190 mandates in single mandate races, and it can get qualified majority at the Duma. Speaking about Ilya Yashin's report, I would say that there is nothing new in all this news. What is new is that the facts the gathered, and they did create a pretty impressive picture, but I don't think that this impressive picture will impress ordinary voters, first due to the fact that ordinary voters will not read this report, at least before voting. And second, sociological polls are showing that voters do know this, do know all these accusations, but nevertheless, they are eager to support the order in a way it exists now, and the fact that one or other official from the party of power is corrupt or is criminal doesn't change in general their vision of the world.
Uh-huh. Sean, what were your thoughts on this? Did you see anything here? Though, of course, you didn't see anything that surprised you. There was nothing surprising there. It was kind of striking, though, to see it all kind of wrapped up in one place.
Right.
I mean, Yashin pulled this all together from open source material. There was
no
new investigation here. It was all open source. But to see it all pulled together and to see the scope of it, all spelled out in one report was pretty jarring. What was your reaction to this report, and what kind of an impact do you think? I mean, if you remember, Alexei Navalny in the last Duma election cycle very, very skillfully branded United Russia, the party of Zhulukovivoto, of the swindlers and thieves. And now Ilya Yashin seems to be giving us the proof.
Right. Yeah, I don't really see this having much of an impact, no more than the other reports. It is nice to see all of this culled together, because it paints a picture that, looking at these individual cases, particularly of the criminal group in the Far East of Comey, right?
Right.
You know, these, if looking at them, they look like in isolation. But for me, actually, it raises the question again: what exactly is United Russia? What is its function? Like, what role does it play in Russian society? And it's clear that it is definitely a means of criminality, corruption, as the report points out. It's also, I would like to add on to that report, it's also a means for legal, semi-legal enriching, in the sense that there was a study done, I think RBC did a big investigative report on it, on the relationship between local big business, United Russia party machine, and candidates, and who funds and how much local business is funding the party, and how they're getting rewarded with state contracts.
Yeah, no, that came out a few months ago, and that actually dovetails nicely with this report.
It does, because it paints the larger picture of, well, United Russia isn't necessarily there to represent voters, which nobody's going to be surprised by, but it is representing somebody. And it's the somebody that it is representing is that it's representing forces, both criminal and corporate, to give them access to state coffers.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that, and on the local level, too, in the oblast level and the provincial level, which I think is really, really interesting, because it shows, and it also shows a couple of things. First off, that it shows the weakness of administrative governance in the provinces. Second, it also shows that these forces in the provinces, these local machines, can have relative possible autonomy from the center. And could prove to be, to bring this back to our discussion in the first part, it could also prove to be yet another problem if the agenda for the future is toward some kind of authoritarian modernization. Mm-hmm. Because you're going to have to not only break the big guys around you, you're going to also have to break the local machines to implement whatever scheme you're going to put forward.
Mm-hmm. Nikolai, what is United Russia for? What is its function? Would you agree with Sean on that assessment?
Yes, absolutely. The problem I see is connected with the fact that the United Russia is not a political party in proper sense. It's just an envelope which is used well, once in 4 or 5 years in order to get majority in regional or federal assembly, but it doesn't exist as a real political party which makes decisions by itself, which governs itself at least. So it's managed from outside, and that's the problem. That's why when being compared to the Communist Party of the Soviet Union, it's not like the Communist Party of the Soviet Union, which used to be a very powerful party. The United Russia is just a brand name. And what is important, I think, now on the eve of elections to speak about, it's the fact that due to switch to the mixed electoral system, when half of Duma deputies should be elected in single mandate districts, the Kremlin somehow fixed one problem, the problem of how to keep dominance over the State Duma in spite of crisis and decline of the party of power popularity, which is inevitable. So they do reach this goal. But the cost they should pay is connected with the fact that no more deputies at the State Duma will be that manageable, even being the United Russia members, the members of the United Russia faction. They will have a rather complicated loyalty. Not only they should be loyal to party bosses, federal party bosses, but they should be loyal to regional political elites, and to a certain extent even to their voters, which will make politics much more sophisticated. And here I'm coming to the question you put in the first half of our discussion, whether Volodin can come to the State Duma. Mm. We can speculate whether Volodin or somebody else, but it's understandable that the new Duma will be very different from the old one, and it should be managed in much more sophisticated way. And Volodin's experience in public politics helps or can help him to be a good political manager, unlike Naryshkin's lack of experience in this kind of political games.
That's interesting. So moving Volodin from the Kremlin to the Duma isn't a matter of weakening the Kremlin and downgrading Volodin, but it's more a matter of more effectively managing the Duma. That's interesting. I hadn't thought of that. Sean, does that make sense to you? That's interesting.
Yeah, that is actually quite interesting. And it also shows too a different way that maybe we should regard some of the moves that are going on. That it's and Mark Galeotti has pointed this out too. And it also corresponds with the corruption issue, and that is that with the shrinking pie of to extract from. You have to also narrow the limits of acceptable graft, as Nikolai has pointed out. And so some of these moves might be just sheer putting more competent people in positions as a way to manage the waste and manage the corruption to acceptable levels for the current conditions.
These Duma elections are, I think, are going to be an interesting watershed. I mean, from my perspective, Duma elections in Russia are actually bigger political watersheds than presidential elections. They seem to always kind of herald the beginning of some kind of new political reality, even more so than the presidential election. So I think we'll all have our eyes on this in 16 days' time. And on that note, we'll wrap it up. That's all we have time for today. I'd like to remind you, you've been listening to the Power Vertical Podcast. My name is Brian Whitmore, author of the Power Vertical blog here at RFRL. Joining me on the Skype line from Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, has been Sean Guillory of the University of Pittsburgh Center for Russian Eastern European Studies, author of Sean's Russia blog and host of the SRB podcast. And joining us from Moscow has been political analyst Nikolai Petrov of the Center for Political and Geographical Studies. Thank you, gentlemen, for an enlightening and interesting discussion.
Thank you.
And I'd also, I'd also like to thank our producers, Tanya Kancheva and Pavel Balak, and my totally awesome and indispensable colleague, Pavel Butorin, managing editor of RFRL's Russian language television program, Current Time, which you can watch at www.currenttime.tv. I'd also like to remind you, you could subscribe to the Power Vertical podcast on iTunes. You can read the Power Vertical blog and watch the Daily Vertical at RFRL.org. And you can follow us on the Twitter at Power Vertical. Join us again next week. And now, as always, I leave you with the ambient sounds of my favorite socially conscious Russian rapper, Noise MC.